Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The first time I saw Maestro Delta David Geyer outside the concert hall, and this was years and years ago, we were at a gym. He was on the treadmill, I was on the track. The maestro had headphones on, and my curiosity at that moment was almost overwhelming. What was he listening to? All these years later, I finally got an idea of what rolls around in Geyer's head when he can listen to whatever he wants. It might not be what you expect. As we kick off a new series on In the Moment called Summer with the Symphony, we begin this week by welcoming Delta David Geyer to talk about music and culture and the gamelan. All right, we'll start with the music that we just heard coming in out of the break, because this is something that you're listening to in your leisure time. Tell me about it.
Well, I mean, people will often say, you know, what do you listen to when you're not listening to classical music? And the fact is, you talk about hearing voices in your head and that not being a healthy thing. I always have voices in my head. They have names like Mahler, Beethoven, you know, like it's always going on. So in order to silence those voices, I kind of need something else. But the thing that interests me most is world music, music of all different cultures. And so what you just heard, that little intro, was Balinese gamelan music. And I was just in Bali last summer, and actually got to sit down with this ensemble and had a little lesson in playing gamelan with
what
them.
Is it? What does it look like? Describe gamelan.
Well, gamelan's a percussion ensemble, basically. It's and you have various numbers of people playing these mostly metallic instruments that are like xylophones or marimbas, but they're made of metal. They're hit with hammers. There are also gongs that are part of it. But like most world music, folk musics, it's a very participatory kind of thing. So again, that helps me differentiate it from my regular world, which is concert music, a world where people sit and listen attentively to what's being performed. But and across most of the world, of course, music is intended for singing and dancing in a communal sense. And gamelan music is very much like that. A lot of it is also for religious worship. So I just find this really fascinating. It informs a lot of the music that I perform, classical music. Of course, many composers took inspiration from folk music, world music, their own, such as Dvorak, for instance, putting Czech folk music into his symphonies. But then there were, you know, composers who took inspiration from other cultures, and like around the turn of the last century, the Paris Exposition would bring in like dancing troupes and musicians from all over the world. And that's where Debussy and Ravel first heard gamelan music. And then they ended up incorporating this music into their works. The Mother Goose Suite of Ravel, for instance.
Is there a line for composers from incorporating something that they've heard from a folk tradition or from a culture that's not their own, and then sort of cultural misappropriation?
Yeah, well, that's just such a hot topic in our day. And I can sort of see why, but I mean, the topic would be multiculturalism in music, which what we think of as classical music has always been multicultural. 300 years ago, multiculturalism in music was Bach sitting in Germany writing in the style of the French and the Italians. Well, France and Italy was a lot further away from Germany 300 years ago than it is today.
Right.
And these are cultures that were butting up against each other, and they started influencing each other. And you fast forward 100 years and you have Beethoven and Mozart both incorporating Turkish music into their works because of the Ottoman Empire and the Janissary bands that were canvassing Europe at the time. And you fast forward another 100 years at the end of the 19th century, and composers were really paying homage to other cultures. For instance, Rimsky-Korsakov's Capriccio Español. I mean, Rimsky-Korsakov is a Russian composer, but he's writing in the Spanish style. It's still very much Russian, but it's not. The most beloved opera of all time is Bizet's Carmen, a French composer writing about a flamenco dancer in Andalusia. You know, so that's always been part of the game of classical composers. And now today, we literally have composers in every corner of the globe. I just got back from Thailand last night, conducting the Thailand Philharmonic, and we played music of Bartok, for Pete's sake. You know, what's the Thailand Philharmonic doing playing Bartok? They played 5 Mahler symphonies this year on their season.
Wow.
You know, it's like, what is it about this that enables people to come in touch with one another in very authentic ways, deeply moving ways? It's so different from reading a book about another culture. You know, you're coming in contact with that culture. With the cultural appropriation versus misappropriation question, we actually really delved into that a couple of seasons ago. The first time we worked with Joseph Horowitz and his Music Unwound project was a program called Dvorak and America. And in it, I mean, the program was basically about the 3 years that Dvorak spent in the United States. And Dvorak was brought to the United States by a visionary woman named Jeanette Thurber, who basically founded what is today the Juilliard School. But one of the things she was also after was the engendering of a truly American form of composition. Because up until that time, American composers were imitating European composers. It was basically bad Brahms, you know, that our guys were writing. So, and Dvorak was smitten with American culture, particularly African American and Native American music. He had African American students at his school in New York City, and they would sit around and sing gospel hymns and old slave haulers and things. Like, he just couldn't get enough of it. Now, is that cultural misappropriation to love it and to be fascinated by it? And for that music to then find its way into Dvorak's New World Symphony?
Right.
Is that misappropriation, or is that paying homage, you know, with respect to another culture?
Right.
Dvorak's Ninth Symphony, part of which was the inspiration came from a summer that he spent in Spillville, Iowa, watching the Kickapoo Medicine Man show, you know, but coming in contact with Lakota and Dakota people, also gave him inspiration. And basically he said, he's quoted as saying that America has everything it needs right in its own soil for a truly American music, and it is in the indigenous musics of the Native American and the African American. And So another inspiration that Dvorak had for his New World Symphony was Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's Song of Hiawatha.
Right.
So that may even be more to the point of this cultural appropriation thing, because today Longfellow is looked at with disdain as a cultural thief. The fact is that in the mid-19th century when he wrote that he had very good relationships with Native Americans and he was respected by them. And his Song of Hiawatha was seen as, you know, maybe naive, but at least, a white man's attempt to pay homage to this culture.
Right.
But now, you know, we talk about the shores of Gitche Gumee and things like this. These have become sort of cultural, you know, they're black spots.
Right.
You know. And so what we tried to do in the program was shift gears in the middle of the program. I basically rewrote Joe's script and incorporated part of our Lakota Music Project into it. And what we did was to try to deal with this misappropriation question head on. So we played a bit of Victor Herbert's Natoma, the Dagger Dance, which is the, you know, the boom, 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 boom. It's like kitschy kind of Native American, just trying to make fun or, you know, whatever that is.
A stereotype. Yeah.
Yeah. A bad one. I basically from the stage asked the question, you know, okay, so what is cultural misappropriation? So, like I say, we played that, and we showed a clip of a Hams beer commercial from the 50s. From the land of sky blue waters. The don't, boom, 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 boom,
right.
Boom, you know. And everybody cracked up, those in the room who remember that, that old jingle. And then we flashed... on the screen, we flashed logos from sports teams,
mm-hmm.
the Washington Redskins, the Atlanta Braves, so on, Cleveland Indians.
Right.
And so, okay, this is clearly cultural misappropriation.
Right.
You know, that is not what Dvorak was after. That is not what Longfellow was after. But the problem is, of course, we look back through the last 100 years... through a lens of commercialism, basically.
Right, yeah.
And people using these cultures. I mean, have you watched Peter Pan lately? What Makes the Red Man Red?
Mm.
I mean, that is supremely offensive stuff.
Right.
You know? And my kids grew up like watching that before I moved to South Dakota. You know? And now it's like, I can't even imagine. You know? It's too bad. But that's, again, not what Dvorak was after. So,
yeah.
So today when I go, you know, we just played a Chinese piece with the Thailand Philharmonic last week by Joe Long. I had to talk to the orchestra about it. I mean, Thailand is they're neighboring with China, obviously, but don't really know that much of the history of it. And Joe Long grew up during the Cultural Revolution. And a lot of his music has to do with reckoning with the atrocities that happened. His wife Chen Yi tells a story about being at home as an 11-year-old, and her parents were both university professors, and they were both taken away in the middle of the night, and she and her younger brother left alone in the middle of the night, and she ended up going to a labor camp.
Wow.
And, you know, like, and this happened to Geelong, too. And so they're trying to now reconcile that with their culture. And the piece we played by Geelong was called The Immortals. And The Immortals were the artists, thousands of years worth of artists and intellectuals in China that were basically whitewashed during the Cultural Revolution. Mm. And so he, through his music... which incorporates a lot of sounds from the Beijing opera. Bizarre sounds to our ears, but very culturally relevant to them. He incorporates this and pays homage to that. And it's an opportunity for us to come in contact with that culture and to have some understanding and insight into it. This is not appropriation of any kind.
Briefly to this, where we started with world music and with your travels over the summer, because you've got the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra season is complete for the year, but you're not, in the lawn chair with the book yet.
No, that's not happening
this summer. With a cocktail in your hand.
This is not happening this
summer. What do you have on your schedule? You've already been to Thailand once.
Yeah, I go back to Thailand in September and October, actually. In between, I go to Canada this week. The next week, I go to Poland. I got a couple of things in the States. I go to Hungary for a festival at the beginning of August that I do every year. I go to China for a week towards the end of August. First weekend of September, I'm in Brazil before I go back to Thailand again. And then I come back and our season starts. So, it's... lots of different music, some that I've done before, some that's brand new. But all of it, all of the music informs each other. It all makes it a stronger kind of structure. It's sometimes I just have to pinch myself, because it's such a privilege to get to do this kind of work. Exhausting, yes, but joyful.
Audiences are different. Audiences are they characterized the same? Can you tell what country you're in based on the audience?
It's very different experience. I mean, last summer I did a tour with the Thailand Philharmonic, and we went down through the south of Thailand into Malaysia, and we were in Yalah, which is the largest city in that southern part of Thailand, and there have been thousands and thousands of people killed within the last 10 years because of Muslim extremist violence in that part of the world. And yet here we are playing Shostakovich and Thai music as well. And, it was a little bit of concern. You go to the hotel and, like they say, don't leave the hotel. Mm. Do not leave. We will pick you up. We'll take you to the concert hall. We'll bring you right back. We'll have food for you. Like, do not leave the hotel. And especially at night. But the audience, so we didn't know what we were going to find, right. In an oppressed region like that. Absolutely packed.
Really?
Just packed to the gills. It's such an appreciative audience. It was a moment of joy for them that they probably don't get, Then we crossed over into Malaysia, and it was party time. It was what a happy bunch of people. One of the things I enjoy going to Hungary every summer is I lived in Romania for a couple of years early on when I started conducting, and I worked in Eastern Europe a lot. And they have this tradition there where when they really love something, the audience has a... What happens is everybody's applauding, and then there starts to become a collective rhythm. And then they start to, they listen and they capture the rhythm and they start clapping together and they make an accelerando and then it breaks down and it applause and then it comes again.
Oh,
it's
wow.
Like wave after wave after wave after wave. And applause after concerts there will go on for 6, 8, 10 minutes.
Wow.
And you have to come back on stage 10 or 12 times. It's like, come on, I want to go to bed.
That was it. That's the show.
But, they keep you there all night if they could. So it's a different experience, I come back here and, I joke with people about it. I tell my colleagues, it's like you have the obligatory standing ovation in South Dakota. Like, I basically tell our guest artists, if they give you a standing ovation, it doesn't really mean anything.
Oh, no.
But if you can get these Norwegians yelling, sure, then you know you've struck a vein.
Okay. Like,
if they start yelling, then we know we've really impressed them.
About world music, how much does that sort of inform what you already do? Are you seeking out new things all the time? Do you sort of go back to your old favorites? How do you approach that?
I don't listen to a lot of music over and over again. I can't think of anything, actually. Because it gets stuck in my head, and I can sort of I can actually push, you know, play in my brain if I need to, and it just goes. But and I have to stop it. So the music that I listen to does inform other things. Like, I don't listen to the same music twice, generally. I'm sort of musically omnivorous. And what I find is that I take inspiration from... Yeah, sometimes from the performers, but mostly from the music itself. So, for instance, this gamelan music, it has a very long structure to it, sort of like Indian classical music, like South Asia, which can go on for hours sometimes and shift sort of glacially. And you have to listen very carefully to it. But the gamelan is like that in a sense. But I find those things fascinating. But also for me, the takeaway is how I get that sort of larger structure in a symphony, for instance. Mm-hmm. If I've got an hour's worth of a symphony to conduct, how do you make that one piece? How do you conduct it in such a way that it has direction from beginning to end? And so you're not stuck in the moment, you know, just listening to what's happening right now. Because composers don't write that way. I mean, there's a lot of detail to get stuck in if you really want to do that, but there are structures that composers use, and it's intended to take you on a journey. And there's no place to really just stop and kick up your feet during the journey. You're always going, should always be moving forward in it. So listening to how other people tell stories through music helps me to tell my story better, or to tell the composer's story more accurately.
Let's close with this notion of the voices in your head that are sort of always there. Just from a personal standpoint, is it ever silent in there? Do you want it to be? How do you give yourself the rest and the time away from something? Or is it an ongoing obsession minute by minute?
It's ongoing. And the answer to your question is, yeah, sometimes I do wish that it would go away. In a spiritual sense, you know, when it comes to contemplation and just quieting the mind. It's something towards which I aspire, but these voices of Mahler and Beethoven, they don't shut up very easily. They come into play all the time, which is, they're not bad bedfellows,
right?
Honestly,
they're still around for a reason.
Yeah, it's absolutely that way, But, you know, perhaps someday I'll find a little better balance. But in the meantime, you know, it's not a bad place to be.
Well, for the rest of us as well.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.